I'm John Nichols from Free Press, and this is your National Conference for Media Reform. You have come from 50 states, every state in this union, from the District of Columbia, which still needs representation in our Congress, from Puerto Rico, from Canada, from Brazil, from China, from India, from Mexico, from Great Britain, Korea, Switzerland, Australia, and France. And you have all come because you believe, as the greatest political analyst of the 1960s, Curtis Mayfield, said, people get ready, there's a train a-coming. You don't need no baggage, you just get on board. It is a train of justice. We have media justice in this room. It is a train of indie media. We have indie media in this room. It's a train of community radio stations from across this country. Community radio, public radio activists. This is a justice train. This is a freedom train. It's a democracy train. And it is taking us, rolling toward that promised land where media serves not corporate needs, but human needs. Where media treats us not as consumers to sell something to, but as citizens of a great democracy. Where our children are not carpet bombed with 20,000 commercials by the age of 5, but are educated and inspired to be the next generation of citizens. Where every voice, black and brown, gay and straight, left and right, immigrant and indigenous, is reflected in our newspapers, our television, and our radio. Where journalists refuse to be stenographers to power. Where the lies and the liars who would send our children to distant lands to die are exposed before those wars begin. Where our media is as good and humane and responsible and honorable as the American people it is supposed to serve. Where we part the Red Sea of lies and push ourselves forward to that plain of truth where democracy and justice is not seen as something we have to beg for, but is something that is real in all of our lives. This is what brings us to St. Louis, Missouri, in the middle of America, beneath the great arch of exploration, to explore the new promise of this country. This is where a young man named Joseph Pulitzer, more than 100 years ago, started a newspaper called the Post-Dispatch. And when he started that newspaper, he had a set of principles that he talked about what media ought to be. 100 years ago, the North American Review asked him to say, you know, where should media fit into this whole process of a democratic experiment? Pulitzer said, our republic and its press will rise or fall together. An able, disinterested, public-spirited press with trained intelligence to know the right and the courage to cover the right can preserve the public virtue without which popular government is a sham and a mockery. A cynical, mercenary, demagogic press will produce in time a people as base as itself. The power to mold the future of the republic will be in the hands of the journalists of future generations. Joseph Pulitzer would be horrified by what our media has become and what it has done to the American people. We come to St. Louis, to Joseph Pulitzer's town, to say no more. No more do we make a lie of his promise. of what he said that media ought to be. We come to his town and we say the media in this city must cover the cause of the coalition against police crimes and repression, which is seeking to expose the crisis of killing of young black men in this city. They have a petition here asking you to sign, to join on and be a part of pressuring not just the media, but this community to address these fundamental issues. Sign that petition, be a part of that struggle. Not anybody go to that party last night? That was not a bad party. And that was organized by our friends and comrades at KDHX. Community Radio and Television here in St. Louis. They are local. They are not for profit. They are the best face of St. Louis. And we are honored to have with us to issue her welcome our friend, our comrade, Bev Hacker, the executive director of KDHX.
Welcome to St. Louis. So all of you that were at the party last night, I hope you had a great time. And those that missed it, you missed a heck of a party. So we are part of the independent media here in St. Louis. We are KDHX. And we're proud to say that we are volunteer operated. Everybody on the air is a volunteer. And we do the things that the mainstream media won't do. We have radio, we have public access television, and we have community access television. It's important to us to be part of the community and to be part of independent media in this country. It's important to us to do the kinds of things that you all are doing here as part of the media reform movement. I was really fortunate enough about a year and a half ago to go to the first media reform conference, and I walked away with an amazing amount of knowledge. And I've been doing this for about 15 years, and I learned so much there. And I was energized, and I was ready to go back and teach people about media and teach people about the need for media reform in this country. So my hope for you is that when you walk away from this conference, that you'll feel the same way that I did, that you'll know that change can come, that you can make the change, that you can be a part of the change to make this all happen. So welcome. Have a great time in St. Louis. If you haven't had the opportunity, we have a local information booth out there. So please check out our city while you're here and have a great time at the conference. And I promised Bob McCannon that I would say that tonight there's an Acme meeting in the Martini Bar at 5:30. So thank you so much and have a great time and welcome to St. Louis.
Bev Hacker, KDHX.
What is Acme?
Acme is, where's Bob McCannon? Right, where is he? Yell it out, Bob.
Action Coalition for Media Education, and there's a table in the exhibit room.
Thank you, Bob McCannon. Who doesn't have their What the FCC pin yet? Who doesn't? All right, there you go. They're giving out the What the FCC pins. Everybody's wearing them. All the kids have got them. You know, for years, Bob McChesney and I lived up in Madison, Wisconsin. I'd ride my bike over to his house. We'd sit around at night and talk about, wouldn't it be cool if there was a media reform movement? And we were, you know, an academic and a journalist, two of the less useful people on the planet. And then we encountered a young man who had been involved in the campaign finance reform movement, and he had come to recognize that every time they tried to fix our broken and corrupt political system in this country, when they got to Washington, the lobbying force that stopped them wasn't corrupt politicians. It was big media, those television stations that wanted to keep all the ads. So he approached us and said, you know, look, I'd like to help you do some organizing. And in fact, it wasn't help, it was do the organizing. He is our friend, he is our comrade, he is the boss of Free Press, Josh Silver.
Thank you. You'll have to forgive me, my voice is going, so I'll do my best. Thanks so much for being here, everyone. It's such an honor to have this many folks come from so far. I think we have 8 countries here in addition to every state. Up to 10. You're sitting amongst an unprecedented network of regional, national, local groups and individuals working tirelessly for media reform. And the great news about this is that we are actually winning. So I'm here to tell you today about how we're winning, because that's one of the great untold stories that's happening in this country. Because surprise, surprise, the media, the U.S. media, doesn't report it. I know. Everyone, once you've recovered, we've blocked the FCC's effort to make big media get even bigger. And it's because of everybody in this room that happened. And it's because all the people you work with back home. We forced Sinclair to stop airing electioneering as news. And it was all of you that did that. We forced the FCC to investigate payola pundits like Armstrong Williams, who took $250,000 from your money to promote the Department of Education policies. And we uncovered, thanks to good journalists who are out in this crowd, did the same, and were integral to that effort. We forced Congress to last week require that government-funded fake news, covert propaganda, be disclosed, albeit for only 1 year, but it's an important start, and it was because of you. And there's some other quiet organizing happening in the sidelines that people don't know about, that it's crucial that not only we know about, but also that people across this country understand. Community internet, the effort to get the whole future of communications, which is going to be a digital pipe down the road in a few years, TV, internet, phone, all through a digital connection, cable and telephone companies are working tirelessly to make it illegal for anybody but them to offer high-speed internet. This is the future of communications, and grassroots work by you in this room stopped legislation in West Virginia, Florida, Illinois, Indiana, where we pushed back this hostile legislation, and we have cases in Iowa, Nebraska, Texas, Oregon, Ohio, and Louisiana, where the cable and telephone companies are unable to move forward because of us. And cable franchise renewals, a crucial issue, the way that we get independent voices on the air, shows like Democracy Now!, more carriage for other shows that are independent and non-commercial. There has been great fights happening on the ground in states like Arizona, where we beat back hostile legislation that would have seriously hindered the public's ability to increase diversity on cable television. So we have 125 groups representing 20 million Americans who signed the Bill of Media Rights. We've seen a very loud and effective response to efforts by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the White House to inject partisan politics into our public broadcasting system. There's a lot of victories I'm leaving out. One of the plenaries that's going to happen this weekend is called The Fight of Our Lives. And this is not hyperbolic. We understand, we're here because we understand how bankrupt our media system really is. We understand that our democracy truly hangs in the balance. We understand that we're part of a movement that is growing at astonishing speed. People said the media reform movement could never come together, that it was too fractured, that all the different groups and different interests could not communicate or collaborate. I've worked on other issues, I've read about the others, and I'm here to tell you that the victories that we've had, the growing momentum, the excitement that you feel when you look around this room, that you can feel in this room, has proven the skeptics wrong. And we are a more unified and more organized movement than we ever have been before, and we've just begun. I also want to just make a note, just so that this doesn't get omitted from this weekend. I think it's really important. This is one of my pet issues that I hope people will think about when you go home. We really do need to support some of the other structural issues that are absolutely crucial to making this country better. We cannot forget about campaign finance reform. We cannot forget about redistricting and how we have to reinstall democracy into Congress. We cannot forget about election reform and the importance of fair elections. So here we are, and we're keenly aware of why we're here. We understand that the victories of the past years have happened amongst one of the most hostile political environments this country's ever seen. And we are just beginning. We are not going to rest until we build a media system that represents all people, that holds government accountable, that educates our children, that nourishes democracy, justice, and civil society, not just media corporations. So on behalf of Free Press staff, our volunteers, board members, countless people, too many to name, who made this event possible, I welcome you to St. Louis.
People get ready. There's a train coming, and you know when the train comes, it's very hard to make sure that everybody's on board and in the right room. When you have 2,500 media reform activists in the same place, you have 5,000 opinions and 10,000 questions. There's one person who has had the responsibility of answering all those questions and pulling this event together. She has been its organizer, its coordinator, the woman with the whip, who has made all of us do the things that she says must be done, and the reason that this is working today. Please welcome the organizer of this conference, Yolanda Hippensteel.
Hi, everybody. Thank you so much for being here. This event has been a long time in the planning and in the coming. It's been really a year of blood, sweat, and tears, and so it's so wonderful and gratifying to see you all here together. And it really, really feels good for me personally, as well as the rest of the Free Press staff here. So thank you all for being here. I also want to send a couple quick thanks to some great people who have helped with this. We saw Bev Hacker and her colleagues, Nico Leone and Greg Gibson, as well as the other KDHX staff, have been so helpful and have been such wonderful local hosts. And they really put on a great party last night. So let's give them a hand, please, one more time. Thank you, Bev. Also want to thank quickly our outreach committee, a committee of five people who did amazing work reaching out and trying to get a lot of people to come to this conference, but in particular people from constituencies that are often underrepresented in media policy work. Our outreach committee is Val Benavides, Josh Breitbart, Lian Chin, Melkia Cyril, and Tony Riddle, and they also did all of the review of the scholarship applications and brought in, I think, 170 scholarship recipients to be here today. So thank you to all of you for your hard work. And of course, I want to thank so much our wonderful Free Press staff that's out there working hard and busting their butts. Yes, Free Press staff. As well as the volunteers, we have 50 volunteers, almost all from St. Louis, who have come in and have been schlepping boxes of packets and stuff and everything and are directing people to where they need to be. So their work here is certainly instrumental. Thank you. Thanks also to Free Press's wonderful board, who have been so supportive and helpful to us. Thanks to our funders who have made this event possible. To the panelists and speakers, 150 of you who have taken your weekend to help share your experiences and knowledge and perspective. Thank you. Thanks again to everybody who's made this possible. So I'm just going to give a really quick overview of what you're all going to do here for the next 3 days. The theme for the conference is gathering momentum. I think you've seen that on most of our flyers. What's that about? It's about really building on some amazing organizing work that's happened, especially over the past couple years. And Josh has laid out some of the important victories that we've seen, but there's a lot more work to do. And we're here gathering momentum for some really key policy battles that are going to be taking place over the next couple years, in particular, a rewrite of the Telecom Act, which is upcoming, and you'll hear about that in a panel over the weekend today, I think. And with so many crucial media policy decisions happening in the next couple years, it's really imperative that we have citizens and communities, regular people, who know about these policies and get their voices heard in media policy decision making. So that's what we're doing here this weekend, and that's why we're focusing this conference really on media policy and activism for media policy. We hope that the event will energize and inspire and inform and really help activists also make the connections that they need and share successful strategies and help build momentum in those ways. So, what are you going to be doing for the next 3 days? You've got your conference packet, so I won't belabor this, but just want to point out a couple of key aspects of the program. Besides our 50 panels and workshops, we also have videos that will be screening all day today and tomorrow in the Chodo Room. The Media Education Foundation will be showing a lot of their videos as well as other media-related films there. We've got our Media Democracy Showcase over in the exhibit hall this way. That'll be open this evening and all day tomorrow, and we've got 70 media activist organizations in there showcasing some of the work that they've been doing and helping you all understand how you can connect with the work that they're doing. And also tomorrow evening there'll be a special session in there, a meet and greet, where there'll be representatives from each of the organizations there staffing the tables and letting you know about the work that they're doing. So please visit them tomorrow evening in the showcase. Tomorrow at 4, we have a round of caucuses, and I think that's something we didn't have at our last year's conference that I think will be really important this year, a chance for different constituency groups to get together and talk about how to build that particular constituency's involvement in media reform. And if you've got a constituency or a group that you'd like to hold a caucus for that's not listed, not formally organized in the process, we have meeting space available to do that, and you can organize that sort of meeting. Just go to the info booth, get a room, and be all set. And that's true also if you want to organize other meetings throughout the conference. I know this can be a great chance for networking, and it's kind of hard to fit that in sometimes with panels, great panels happening all the time. But if you want to schedule a room to hold a meeting, go to the info booth and you can do that. We're going to have a great reception tonight. We have a wonderful performer, Fontella Bass, who's an R&B legend, local here from St. Louis, will be performing this evening here in this ballroom. So we hope to see you all here tonight. And we'll also, on Sunday morning, we've got a really great round of action clinics. And one of the key pieces of feedback we got from our last year's conference was that people left feeling really energized and inspired, but they weren't so clear on what they can do when they left the conference. So the Sunday morning round of action clinics will really help give you the skills and how-to tips that you need to take an action home with you and do that when you leave. So I encourage everybody to go to that, but I'm making it a little harder for you. The action clinics were scheduled at 9, and I'm afraid to say that we've had to bump those up to 8:30. So don't party too hard on Saturday night, but there's a good reason we're bumping those to 8:30, and it's that Bill Moyers called us up recently. So Bill Moyers is going to be able to join us on Sunday morning, but we still want to be able to close it out for you at 12:30 to get you all home for your flights. So action clinics, 8:30 to 10:30 on Sunday morning, and then the closing session will be 11 to 12:30. That'll be Bill Moyers as well as some of the other speakers that are listed already on the closing plenary. So that's it for program stuff. I want to remind everybody that there's an info booth out there if you need any help. KDHX is also have staff there with local information maps if you want to see about the city. Check in with them. All the Free Press staff have these little purple ribbons on our name badges, so if you want to track any of us down, if you need info, you can. Volunteers have teal ribbons. Grab them if you need anything. And besides that, just thank you for being here. I hope you have a great time. Learn, share, network. Have a little fun if you can. And enjoy your time here in St. Louis. Thank you all for being here.
I'm a little disappointed. You know, it was a good round of applause when you heard that Bill Moyers is coming to St. Louis to be with us in the midst of this struggle over PBS to demand that we restore our public broadcasting system in this country to the place where it ought to be. Bill Moyers coming here to be with us and to say, this is the movement that is going to restore public broadcasting. We've had a lot of tremendous people are coming out. I'll give you one other program note. This afternoon, Patti Smith will be at 4 o'clock. You do have it in your program. She'll be in the field room to talk about rock and roll and why you don't hear much of it on the radio anymore. Now, I want to remind people, you know, so many people come up to Bob McChesney and myself and they'll say, thank you for doing this. And, you know, of course, we're not immodest people. And so we always say, oh, it's nothing. I know. The fact is, it really is nothing. What we've done is stand on the shoulders of giants. And when I look out at this room, I see a number of them. Don Hazen from Alternet, who had some of the first great conferences on media, is with us. Danny Schechter, the news dissector, is with us. Makani Thembo, who's done so much on media justice, is with us. From Great Britain, our friend Granville Williams of the Campaign for Press and Broadcast Freedom, who provided us with the inspiration. But I do think it is fair to say that one man, with his writings and his passionate activism on the issues of media ownership and consolidation and concentration, opened all of our eyes and played a critical role in taking a set of good ideas, a set of deep complaints and concerns, and making them into a movement. That man is my friend, my co-author, my colleague, and my comrade, Bob McChesney.
John, you're the music fan. What's the line in that Bob Dylan song, Positively 4th Street? I wish one time you could stand inside my shoes. It wouldn't be a drag this time. I wish you all could stand inside my shoes and look out and see what I'm seeing right now. It's an extraordinary, unbelievable picture. The collection of people here, John's named three of them. We could name every person in this room. Every one of you deserves a round of applause for being here. Yeah, really, it's true. This is a historic moment in our country's history, not just for media, but I think for politics. It's a watershed. It's a turning point. Where it's going to go, we don't know. One of the delightful things about the period we're in with media is that we have a crisis. And in a crisis, as the famous Chinese character puts it, it's made up of the terms for danger and opportunity. We have now tremendous opportunities to make things better, or things could get a lot worse. They could get considerably worse. Consider, for example, what John just said about public broadcasting. Public broadcasting has been on a downward slope for some time in this country. It is a service that has serious problems with its great strengths. Right now, we have an explicit attack violating law, and have the body that was supposed to be the heat shield to protect public broadcasting from partisan interference, the person who's the head of that body now engaging in partisan interference. Oh, we don't have any proponents of that. Well, the good news is, this is an opportunity for us. This has so outraged the American people, much more than media ownership. It's unbelievable, the response to this. It creates an opportunity for us to talk with the American people about what we really want from our public broadcasting, how we want media to serve our communities, to get this issue out in the public, to talk about censorship. This is a phenomenal organizing opportunity for all of us in this room to educate, to do outreach, to draw people into our movement, and it's going to be a powerful moment for us. We are in a moment of danger, in a moment of spectacular opportunity. 5 years ago, if someone was asked, what's the nature of the media reform movement in the United States, probably would have said, well, there is no such thing. I mean, what are you talking about? Media to most people were like the Rocky Mountain Range. You get in your car today and you drive to California and the Rockies get in your way. And they're a pain in the butt if you've got an old beater and you've got to climb those hills. And you say, well, there's nothing I can do about it. The Rockies are there. And that's how people regarded media. You thought the coverage was terrible of a war. You thought communities, local communities weren't being covered. You didn't like the commercial carpet bombing of your children or the entire entertainment culture. You felt helpless. It was the Rocky Mountain Range. But something has happened in the last 5 years. A switch has gone off. Increasing numbers of Americans have come to realize that our media system is not a free market system. It's nothing ordained by the Founding Fathers. System based on corrupt policies made behind closed doors by very powerful special interests and their bought off politicians. And as people understand that, then they get outraged and they get organized and they stand up and say, policies made in my name have to be made with my informed consent. Policies made in my name have to be made with my informed consent. We saw 3 million people, approximately, we don't know the exact number, but millions, rise up to oppose media consolidation in 2003. Since then, that seems like the War of the Roses now. So much has been happening in the last year and a half. This movement has grown so dynamically. You all know, for example, the enrollment here. We had to close it off. We probably could have had twice as many people at this conference had we, had the space for it than we have. You can probably go out and hawk your registration on the black market and pay for a trip to Europe. This is a hot item we've got here. Who would have thought that 5 years ago? Getting into a media reform conference would be a hot ticket in St. Louis, Missouri. Just recently, MoveOn.org and True Majority polled their hundreds of thousands of members about what the most pressing issues of our times are. Number two in both lists, media reform. Number two. We've come a long way, but we have a very long way to go. The great news, though, and what should give us all inspiration is organizing around this issue is not hard. Going out and talking to people about the problems with our media and the solutions for what we can do about it is like throwing a seed on 10-foot deep Illinois topsoil. There is people respond, they soak it up. All we have to do is organize, and we will win. All we have to do is organize, and we win. All we have to do is make this an issue the public talks about, and we win. That's why the other side is dedicated and devoted to keeping this behind those closed doors, to making sure we don't talk about it, to make sure the decisions are made so the Ken Tomlinsons of the world, the only one who notices what they're doing are people in, behind closed doors in Washington, not on the streets of St. Louis or Springfield, Illinois, or Los Angeles, California. And that's what we have to do, take it to the public. And that's the measure of this movement and how quickly we've grown. We have a conference here, as you know. The first one was 18 months ago. We're having one now. There will be another one probably in 18 months. You all know Moore's Law, the famous dictum that every 18 months, the power of semiconductors doubles. But we have a Moore's Law for this movement. Every 18 months, we're doubling. And that's the rate we're growing at, too. And we've probably got some math whizzes in here. You do the math. That means we're going to win. And we're going to win not too far down the road if we keep it up. It's in our hands. We have the power to do that. Today, we have a phenomenal opening session for you. I'd like our panelists to come up here, please, and join me now. And as they're walking up, I'll give you their names. I'll introduce each of them separately before they speak. But please join me in welcoming Janine Jackson, Mark Cooper, Malkia Cyril, and Amy Goodman.
Who are we missing? You can sit wherever you want. I'm going to sit here, though.
Our first speaker is a dear friend of mine, someone who I've known for a long time, and someone who I think for many of you needs no introduction. She is works at the organization Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. That is an applause line. Let's go here. She's the co-host of their radio program Counterspin. That's another applause line. And I will consider this conference an enormous success if every one of you make sure you and your two closest right-wing friends gets a subscription to Extra Magazine. Buy them a gift just to sort of have fun conversations with them. It's a terrific magazine, and it's something that I use widely in my own work with high-quality media analysis. It's instrumental for all of us in the work we do and doing the criticism that's so necessary for media reform. Janine Jackson is going to be our first speaker today. Please join me in welcoming her.
I'm just quirky enough to prefer to remain seated. I hope you won't mind. I cleared it with as many technical people as I could beforehand, including Amy. So I think... Thank you very much. Good. She's a hands-on kind of host. Oh man, there's more. I apologize. Should I start? Whoa. I think that needs to go there. All right. Well, I apologize for this group of people that can't that I'm not looking at. Most people have heard, most of us in this room are very familiar with that famous quote from the press critic A.J. Liebling when he said, freedom of the press belongs to the man who owns one. I think we all know that. But I keep, recently I keep thinking of another Liebling quote that's less often referred to, in which he referred to the press as the weak slat under the bed of democracy. And he continued, it is an anomaly that information, the one thing most necessary to our survival as choosers of our own way, should be a commodity subject to the same merchandising rules as chewing gum, while armament, a secondary instrument of liberty, is a government concern. A man is not free if he cannot see where he is going, even if he has a gun to help him get there. Now, what year was that from Liebling?
That's like 1960.
That's like 1960, okay? The recognition that we all share, that information is a public good and not a commodity, has a history. The work we're doing now stands on the shoulders of a lot of people whose names we don't know and some whose names we may, like Liebling, Sinclair Lewis, I.F. Stone, George Seldes. But a lot has changed. I think we are in a special moment right now, and a lot has certainly changed since FAIR was founded in 1986. Back then, and I think what's changed is most significantly in people's heads, as Bob has started to say. Back then, as long ago as 1986, a lot of smart, politically active people thought of media as an ancillary issue. There was bad coverage, certainly, of this or that issue, but the media system itself was not considered a sort of contestable terrain. I think there may have been an implicit sense that better media might flow naturally from some of the other social and economic goals that we wanted to achieve. That has changed now. People think differently about media now. Remember how when you used to complain about something you saw on television or heard on the radio, people, even people who agreed with you, would tell you to just turn it off. You don't hear that so much anymore. It's increasingly come to sound as odd as telling someone who's concerned about polluted air, well, just stay inside. You know. The impact and influence of media is undeniable. What's more, we no longer talk about media as a kind of corporate noblesse oblige. You know, it's this magic stuff. We don't even pay for it. You just turn on the TV and there it is. Isn't that wonderful? It's no longer seen as a kind of private enterprise where the public has no standing, if you will, no right to demand accountability or redress. Media is a political issue. And not just that, but it's understood as a keystone issue, like a keystone species, something that is critical, critically affects virtually everything else that we care about. To make change, I think people both need to see that something is wrong and feel that they can do something about it. And I think we're at that point now with media, and we really should take a moment, metaphorically speaking, to appreciate the sea change and the victory that that really represents. Sure, why not? It is a big deal. But I think we also need to appreciate the victories along the way. If you ever fought for a television show to get on the air or stay on the air, if you wrote an opinion column or a letter to the editor, that's ideas that you put in somebody's head that they might not have had otherwise, and that matters. But now we've got people talking about media reform. What I really want to say is now we've won that part. We've got people talking about media reform. As we go forward, we need to keep asking ourselves, media reform for what? Do we want to break up dominant media conglomerations because it just sort of sounds better that there be like a smaller number of companies? No, it's not that. It's not an academic exercise. Media reform is not academic. Bad media hurts real people. Better media would help real people. Media reform means gaining the power to speak and to be heard, and that means taking some of that power from the people who have it now. So media reform is dangerous, done right. So I want to be very clear. I want truly democratic media because 45 million Americans don't have health insurance, and a lot of them think it's their fault. I want democratic media because black and brown kids go to jail because of what somebody read in the newspaper about super predators. I want truly democratic media because public television just said that a family with lesbian mothers is unfit to be acknowledged on the network that you and I pay for. And I want truly democratic media because if we had it, tens of thousands, perhaps 100,000 people who have died in Iraq might be alive today. Media reform is not an academic exercise. It's a crucial problem for our time, and asking ourselves media reform for what will help us keep our eyes on what we are ultimately fighting for. And I think it will also remind us to acknowledge and celebrate the real, concrete successes that we will no doubt achieve on our way towards our bigger goals. So enjoy yourselves this weekend. I could go on more, don't tempt me with that. You're going to hear this weekend about lots of different ways to get involved, and I want to stress that none of them is better than any of the others. Some of them are local, some of them are national, some are more about structure, some are more about content. The point is what engages you, and that's what you have to keep in mind. My husband always talks about a big rock. We're trying to move a big rock. There's lots of handholds on that rock. There's lots of places to put your hand on it, and we need all of them. So enjoy yourselves this weekend. Refuel yourselves, and then get back to work because we need you. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Janine, and Amy, thanks for showing me how to do that. Our next speaker is someone well known to those who work on media reform on a day-to-day basis. He is the research director for the Consumer Federation of America. He has been foundational in generating some of the most important research that has helped us win court cases on media ownership, win court cases on internet access. He is a beacon of light for all of us working in Washington, D.C. On media policy issues. And please join me in welcoming Mark Cooper.
You can tell that I'm supposed to do the analysis part here, and hopefully I won't have too much a downer here because I tend to bring things up. But I only had 10 minutes, and to find a way to tie together the intellectual part and the heart part. And so I figured I would focus on four simple reasons why the momentum for the media reform movement will, in fact, reclaim the First Amendment for the people in the 21st century. Four little reasons: law, history, technology, and economics. The law is on our side. And I want you to recall a movie entitled Four Weddings and a Funeral, because in fact, free speech in the 21st century is being decided by four court cases and a legislative Donnybrook. The four court cases you've heard are Prometheus, which stopped the broadcasters from gutting the media ownership limits; the Brand X case, which turned back the efforts of the cable companies to close the telecommunications network and operate it as a private system; the broadcast flag case just last week, which put the kibosh on the effort of the FCC and Hollywood to control TVs, PCs, and VCRs; and finally, the Grokster case, in which the court refused to shut down file sharing. These four cases were celebrations of freedom of expression and fair use. And the reason the law is still on our side is history. Free speech and fair use are deeply embedded in American democracy. Try as the industry might, they have been unable to get it out because it's ingrained in our DNA. The roads over which Paul Revere traveled to spread the word that the British were coming were available on a non-discriminatory basis under British common law. like the community wireless networks we are building all across this country. The committees of correspondence that awaited his alarm were acts of civil disobedience against commercial monopolists that took place in the cellars and the forests of a continent the British could not control, like the blogs and the websites of cyberspace today. Under our Constitution, ideas are born free, which was a radical concept, and the airwaves belong to the public. Try as they might, they have not been able to get rid of that. Throughout the 19th century, as Bob McChesney has taught us, the penny press and postal subsidies spread information to the populace. And at the end of the 19th century, when the railroads and the telephone companies tried to shut down the new means of commerce and communications, the American people rose up in rebellion in the populist and progressive movements and said no, especially here in the Middle West. So the digital revolution is unsettling the media landscape again. The techies and stock analysts call it convergence. But what is really happening here is dramatic democratization of the means of communication in our society. Computers, communication over the internet, the declining cost of digital production have transformed consumers into producers, listeners into speakers. We are putting the mass in the mass media for the first time in our history. And that is a revolution that is just beginning and will not be turned back. Perhaps the most clear example of that, and one that really shows us the power, is the growth of Wi-Fi networks. You all use them all the time, and they have given rise to our community internet movement. Here we have the best demonstration that not only do the airwaves belong to the people, but they are best managed as a commons, where people are allowed to use the space without being fettered by licenses or excluded by private property. This is our space, and we're using it, and we need to expand it. Whenever powerful entrenched interests lose their technological and economic edge, they turn to the use of force, and that is what is happening today. The desperation is evident in 10,000 lawsuits filed without due process against music file sharers, in the failure of the broadcasters to distribute video programming, digital programming, in the effort of the cable companies to close their networks, in the effort of the telephone companies to prevent cities from paving the streets of the information age by building community wireless networks. So Hollywood, the record companies, the broadcasters, the cable companies, the telcos, lost in court because of history and law. They will go to Congress, and they will have a vehicle. 10 years ago, Congress gave the broadcasters more spectrum for free, but the networks couldn't figure out how to use it. Everybody wants the old stuff back. The Congress wants to sell it to buy more bombs, and they are going to try and push that legislation through. That is our legislative Donnybrook. So now why am I still confident, optimistic, that we will prevail? You are the reason. You are the wedding celebration of democracy. You will not let them do that to us. The stakes are very different. In 1996, it was the cable companies versus the broadcasters, the long-distance companies versus the local companies, the wireless companies versus the wireline companies. That is not the case today. Today, the issue is free speech and fair use. Today, they want to steal our digital future, and we will not let them do that. There was no conference like this in 1995. While they were in their back rooms divvying up the media landscape. There were no technologies of democracy for organizing and funding a people's movement. No bloggers, no meetups. There was no sense of outrage about the manipulation of the media and the masses. There is today. The Communications Act of 2006 will not be written behind closed doors. John F. Kennedy... John F. Kennedy said it well. The hottest places in hell are reserved for those who remain neutral during times of moral crisis. Fewer and fewer Americans are willing to remain neutral. More and more Americans understand that this is a time of moral crisis, brought about in large measure by the failure of our media to provide their function in our society. Fewer and fewer Americans trust the media. That is why they are taking the job into their own hands. You have the historical tradition. You have the technologies of democracy. You have an aroused people. This is a tough revolution. But we will win. We will win not only in stopping the campaign to steal our digital future, but in using the tools of expression, participation, involvement that we develop to drive American democracy to a higher level. That is why I'm optimistic that the movement is gaining momentum. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Mark. This is a heterogeneous movement. We've all talked about that. We see it among us here. We'll see it throughout this weekend. It takes place in Washington, D.C., with activists and organizers and lobbyists there, and scholars and researchers. It takes place all across the country. But there's no doubt, if you understand the logic of this movement, the entire basis of success is putting bottom-up heat from around the country on those above us. It's the only way we can win in this movement. It's the source of all the power we have. All the success we can get in Washington ultimately comes from our ability to arouse people across this country, organize in communities across this country. We have next as our speaker one of the people who's doing that hard work in communities around this country, and there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them, many of them attending this conference. Malkia Cyril is the director of the Youth Media Council, a Bay Area-based youth organizing, capacity building, and media watchdog organization dedicated to developing youth-led strategies for media justice. I've gotten to know her over the last few years as this movement's taken off, and it is my great honor to welcome her to speak to you right now.
I mean, are we winning? I mean, are we winning? So I would be remiss if I didn't start in true activist tradition. When I say media, you say justice. Media?
Justice.
Media?
Justice.
When I say we want, you say justice. We want?
Justice.
We want?
Justice.
See, I am privileged today to be up here with some great minds. And I'm privileged today to be here with all of you. Folks from organizations like Reclaim the Media, Prometheus Radio, Media Alliance, Third World Majority, Media Tank, and the Applied Research Center, and hundreds of others teach me every day that we are winning. We can win. But there continue to be questions about who we are. And I hope to answer some of those questions today. Popular funk musician George Clinton said, and I paraphrase, whoever controls the news determines our destiny. Most of us agree that a fight to determine the destiny of this country is rooted in part in who owns the media and who makes the rules. The question for some of us is how do we surface the historical context of communications and shift the current power relations of the media system? The answer involves, in part, dispelling certain myths about a free press, developing a relevant framework for media reform, and using that reform as a bridge toward justice and real structural change. Let me tell you a little bit about myself, because I like to get personal. I hope there's not too much information. I was born in New York into a childhood marked by the language of super predators and welfare moms 31 years ago. Lies about a steadily growing crime rate and a consistent invisibility about the relationship
between the social conditions of my community and the policy decisions of this nation's leaders was kind of the media that I inhaled every day. This distorted and biased media content told the public a story about the content of my character, a story that built public acceptance for a political war on crime and drugs that led to the incarceration and death of millions, including many I knew and loved. For many of us, media reform is more than a fight for our media, it is a fight for our lives. As we've already heard, we face today a Bush-led war on the world with hundreds of thousands of deaths and even more dangerous times ahead. Our media system represents a crisis of democracy for the vast majority of the population. Our communication rights are one of the many civil rights being rolled back, but not without a fight. From state to state, communities refuse to give up their right to equal media access, fair, accurate, and balanced content, and the power to own and control media infrastructure. From alternative media and public television to cable access, ethnic press, and low-power FM, marginalized communities require a movement that demands telecommunications policies in our interests. When we speak of media reform, the intentions of the quote-unquote framers and constitutional interpretations offer incomplete answers to the questions, what is a free press and how is it guaranteed? We've heard that Jefferson and Madison understood the importance of an astute press in creating the foundation for a strong democracy and protection against elite rule. What remains both invisible and undeniable in the debate about U.S. media is the colonial context of its birth. As the founding fathers were documenting their concept of a free press, they were also building a slaveholding capitalist economy and a white nationalist politic that would entrench media policies and practices for centuries to come. Our current media system reproduces and maintains the colonial power relationships of its beginnings. Understanding the role media plays in creating and perpetuating structural racism and class oppression is not a secondary issue. It is central to building an effective and relevant movement for media reform that fundamentally transforms the U.S. system of communications. By adopting raced, classed, and gendered lens to examine issues of media content, access, and infrastructure, we can dispel three dangerous myths. The first myth is that the U.S. media used to be more democratic and has become less so over time. The fact is, the U.S. media was born of colonial conquest and imperial intrusion, calling the democratic foundations of this press into direct question. For people of color, women, queer people, and young folks, there has never been a free press, and without racial, economic, and gender justice, there never will be. The second myth is that communication rights are inherently individual civil rights guaranteed by citizenship. But what of the millions of undocumented people forced by economic and political conditions to emigrate to this country? What of the millions of incarcerated men, women, and children whose citizenship rights are severed by confinement? What of the black, brown, female, queer, and young people whose basic civil rights require ongoing movements to secure and even then are always in question? Where there is no real mechanism to guarantee civil rights, citizenship offers no protection or guarantee of communication rights. The third and final myth we must dismantle is that we can achieve a free press without also working to end racism, sexism, and class oppression. Nothing could be further from the truth. Before the current trends of consolidation, re-regulation in the corporate interest, and corporate control, the media was simultaneously a tool for civic engagement and a threat to the life and liberty of marginalized communities, and remains so today. In a free market society organized by class, race, and gender, no press can be truly free unless the people who use it and are impacted by it are also free. If we want to bring about real change, the media reform movement must adopt a movement-building analysis, change model, and vision that centers racial, economic, and gender justice. Media justice is a framework for media policy change that seeks to expose structural racism and class oppression in our media system, use local organizing campaigns to root our victories, develop marginalized communities as media activists and leaders, and build an expansive movement for communication rights. We want accountability, alternatives, and a media reform movement that spins on an axis of self-determination and strategic alliance. As a member of the growing media justice movement, we at the Youth Media Council believe there are 5 strategic steps we can take to build an effective movement for media justice. 1, connect media policy to racial justice. 2, use content battles, access fights, and media accountability campaigns to engage new constituencies in the fight for progressive media policy. 3, organize and coordinate from the ground up. 4, use key political moments as strategic opportunities to advance our media policy agenda. Like many of you, we are working to build infrastructure, base, and leaders at the local level to challenge the Bush administration's imminent attack on the 1996 Telecommunications Act. In partnership with Media Alliance and others, we will use the upcoming broadcast license renewal process to challenge corporate control of our airwaves, increase accountability on local radio stations, confront structural racism in the licensing process, and lay the foundation for national opposition to Bush's plan. It is our turn now. It is our time. Marginalized communities care about media reform because our lives and our freedom are at stake. We care because from hip-hop to advertising, media corporations stereotype and exploit the culture of youth and people of color for profit, while those same corporations use our families to create and assemble the technology that makes them rich. We care because our communities remain producers and consumers of a media system over which they have little to no control. But powerlessness is another dangerous myth we must dismantle. Together, we have the combined strategy and skill to dismantle and rebuild this media system. Where the U.S. has used our media to export racism, sell war, and destructively declare itself a singular superpower, the problem of the U.S. media is a problem for the entire world. If I didn't say it before, let me say it now. Victory is imminent. In fact, it is everywhere. From the accountability campaign against Hot 97 in New York, to the Miami-based Immokalee Workers Fight for Low Power FM, marginalized communities are here as stakeholders, as organizers, and as visionaries. A truly free press is our right, and we're damn sure gonna fight for it. Thank you.
Thank you for that phenomenal speech. It used to be, we'd say we can't put anyone after Amy Goodman. Now I don't know. I don't know what we're going to do. I guess there's only one person who can come after Malkia Cyril, and we're very fortunate to have her in the room and sitting right up here on the stage with us. A person who probably needs no introduction to anyone in this room. One of the great developments in my mind of the last 5 years has been the striking emergence of Amy Goodman as a significant journalist across this country with increasing audience, resources, and recognition. Her Democracy Now! Has become mandatory viewing or listening, depending on how you receive it, for millions and millions of Americans, including, I know, many people in this room. Please join me in welcoming Amy Goodman.
Thank you. It's a great honor to be here with all of you, to be here celebrating independent media, working hard to ensure that it grows, it not just survives, but it thrives and it changes the media landscape of this country. 35 years ago today, in Houston, Texas, the transmitter of the Pacifica station there, KPFT, was blown up by the Ku Klux Klan. 35 years ago today, May 13th, 1970. KPFT had just gone on the air 2 months before, and the Klan understood how dangerous Pacifica was. Dangerous because it allowed people to speak for themselves. And that breaks down stereotypes and caricatures that fuel the bigotry that feed these hate groups. And so Klansmen made their way to a field where the transmitter of KPFT was, and they strapped dynamite to it and blew it to smithereens, taking KPFT off the air, yeah, for a couple of weeks. But it was back on. And it was certainly an explosive introduction for the people of Houston to this new media form, and it just drew more attention to this network. A couple months later, they did it again and blew it off the air for 3 months. But Pacifica only grew, and that's what's important. A few years later, the 5th Pacifica station went on the air in Washington, D.C., WPFW, and the 5 Pacifica stations started in 1949 with KPFA. A man named Lou Hill, a World War II conscientious objector, when he came out of the detention camp, said there's got to be a media outlet that is not run by corporations that profit from war, not run by corporations, as George Gerbner, founder of the Cultural Environment Movement, says, not run by corporations that have nothing to tell and everything to sell, that are raising our children today. And so KPFA went on the air, followed by KPFK in Los Angeles 10 years later, 1960, my station WBAI in New York City, and then KPFT and WPFW, the 5 stations. In the 50s, Paul Robeson, one of the great singers, actors, scholars, activists of the last century, when he was whitelisted from almost every public space in this country, but a few black churches, knew he could be heard on Pacifica Radio. This was very profound, Pacifica breaking the sound barrier. James Baldwin, debating Malcolm X over the effectiveness of nonviolent civil disobedience, the lunch counter sit-ins of the South, broadcast over the airwaves of WBAI in the early 1960s. Fannie Lou Hamer, the Pacifica Radio Archives, has the largest collection of recordings of this great civil rights leader anywhere in the world. We have to know our history, the history of grassroots movements. They are the mechanism for change. They are what you are a part of today, and very significant that we are here in St. Louis. When I came in yesterday past a courthouse where Dred Scott had his case first heard, Dred and Harriet Scott challenged slavery in this country. Although ultimately the Dred Scott decision, the Supreme Court ruled that Dred Scott should remain a slave, that as a slave he's not a citizen of the United States and thus not eligible to bring suit in a federal court, and that as a slave he is personal property and has never been free, he launched a movement.
The Civil War ensued. Ultimately, Africans brought to this country freed. He was one of those who freed them. We have to recognize movements and have a media in this country that doesn't focus on celebrity or individuals, but the mechanisms of change that are movements. I was speaking in Minneapolis last Sunday on Mother's Day, thinking about mothers, mothers of movements. Rosa Parks, for example. We all know the story. Launched the bus boycott that led to the Supreme Court decision that desegregated transportation in this country. But she didn't do it alone, and she didn't just do it because she was tired, wanting to sit down. She was an organizer. She worked at the time with the NAACP. She had been to the Highlander Center in Tennessee, and she understood how powerful nonviolent civil disobedience was and chose her moment and got on that bus, paid her token in the front, and then got off. This is how it worked then. So often when the African Americans got off the bus, they had to remount the bus at the back. The bus drivers would move on, so they would have paid but not gone on the bus. And she refused to get up. And she stood up for everyone, and she too launched a movement. It is absolutely critical that we have a media in this country that broadcasts the voices of those at the target end of U.S. foreign and domestic policy. We all know what the media did when it came to the invasion of Iraq. Beat the drums for war day after day. The front pages of the papers of record in this country. The top stories on the networks. And we're not just talking Fox. We're talking CNN, NBC, ABC, CBS. FAIR did that critical study right before the invasion of the 2 weeks around Colin Powell giving his push for war at the UN, looking at the four major nightly newscasts, NBC, ABC, CBS Nightly News, and the PBS NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, the 393 interviews done around war, only three with anti-war leaders or representatives, three of almost 400. That is not a mainstream media. That is an extreme media. It didn't represent mainstream America when most people were opposed to the invasion at that time. The voices that are excluded in this country are not a fringe minority, not a silent majority, but the silenced majority, silenced by the corporate media. We've been on an unembed the media tour for the last month. Yes, we have to unembed the media. The media has reached an all-time low in this country. More powerful than any bomb, than any missile. The Pentagon has deployed the U.S. media, and we have to take it back. The media are the most powerful institutions on earth. They are the way we learn about each other if we don't know each other personally. They are the way we learn about the rest of the world, and they are the way the rest of the world learns about us, and it cannot be through a corporate lens. That is very dangerous. We watch the coverage of the invasion and the occupation by listening to the small circle of pundits on every network who know so little about so much, explaining the world to us. To be here in the city of Pulitzer, I thought it would be particularly relevant to bring one campaign to start it here. Going back to World War II, the media has not just been embedded today. Sure, it's been perfected. Victoria Clark, the former spokesperson, the former Hilla Knowlton employee coming over to be a Pentagon spokesperson, declared embedding a spectacular success. It has been a disaster for the media. We have hundreds of reporters embedded in the front lines of troops. What about in Iraqi communities and hospitals and the peace movement around the world to understand the implications and the repercussions of war? If we saw in this country for just 1 week what they see in other parts of the world, if we saw the images of war, I don't like the whole reality TV craze, but we do need a little reality TV when it comes to war. If we saw for just 1 week babies dead on the ground, women with their legs blown off because of cluster bombs, U.S. soldiers coming home as they have by the thousands in flag-draped coffins or body bags that the Bush administration, President Bush invoking that executive order that they cannot be filmed or photographed, some get out under Freedom of Information Act requests. Yes, they know the power of those images. They're what helped end the Vietnam War, the picture of the girl burning with napalm. Would we see those pictures today? I asked that of Aaron Brown in a discussion we had on Democracy Now. Where are the pictures? He said it's a matter of taste. It's war that is tasteless. We are reporters, not entertainers. It is our job to go to where the silence is. Just imagine if we saw the images, and not just of the soldiers coming home in coffins, but those wounded soldiers, of which there are tens of thousands, who were brought back under cover of night precisely so we don't see them. This is a movement for them as well. One of the big untold stories is the level of resistance in the military today, from the top brass to the lowest level soldiers. Just ask Pablo Paredes, who was court-martialed 2 days ago in San Diego. A young U.S. Navy sailor who refused to be deployed. It's these stories we should hear in the media. And when the trial went on and an international lawyer went on to speak, asked by the government, the prosecutors, if she's saying this war is illegal, is she saying the bombing of Yugoslavia was illegal, is she saying the bombing of Afghanistan was illegal? And she said, yes. And the judge, unprecedented, responded 2 days ago, said the government, the prosecutors, the government has just proven that these soldiers have a reason to believe that the wars in Yugoslavia, Afghanistan, and Iraq are illegal, that there are grounds for them to believe this. I didn't see that on the front pages of the papers, but it is very important we hear these voices like those of Camilo Mejia, who joined Pablo Paredes. He just got out of jail, the Florida Army National Guardsman, who was sentenced to a year in prison, the first for refusing to return to Iraq. He had been there for 6 months, then said he didn't want to go back, offered to testify before Congress about what he had seen about abuse at another detention facility, not Abu Ghraib. It's not just there. And he was court-martialed, and he just came out of jail after almost a year. And if you have to ask, you have to ask, if we lived in a just society, who would be behind bars and who would be free? But going back in this home of Pulitzer to World War II, we can look at the precedents Look at two reporters who covered the dropping of the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We're coming up on the 60th anniversary of the dawn of the nuclear age, August 6th and August 9th, 1945. Those bombs were dropped. One reporter, Wilfred Burchett, independent reporter, and the New York Times reporter, William Lawrence. Wilfred Burchett wanted to see with his own eyes, as a good reporter would, what had taken place in Hiroshima, though General MacArthur had declared the whole area off limits in southern Japan. Sound familiar? And so he got on a train, and for 30 hours he rode to Hiroshima, got off, was horrified by what he saw, shadows burnt in the sides of buildings, people running with their skin melting off, people dying days, weeks after the initial explosion, didn't have the words to describe what he saw. He said, there's some kind of bomb sickness here, an atomic plague. And he sat down in the rubble with his Hermes typewriter and tapped out the words, I write this as a warning to the world. It was a report that shook the world, so much so that the military in this country felt they had to respond and called a group of reporters to New Mexico to counter the Japanese propaganda of radiation sickness. Leader among those reporters was William Lawrence of the New York Times. And he did a series of 10 pieces and denied that people were dying of radiation sickness in Hiroshima. He won the Pulitzer Prize for his reports. It turned out he was also on the payroll of the Pentagon. He was writing the press releases, the statements for President Truman and Secretary of War Stimson, and he was reporting in the New York Times. We have called for the Times to be stripped of that Pulitzer. We need a media that is unembedded in this country, that is separate from the government, that is holding those in power accountable. There's a reason why our job, why journalism, is the only one explicitly protected by the U.S. Constitution, because we are supposed to be the check and balance on government. And as we sit here today, the democratically elected Prime Minister of Haiti lies near death in Port-au-Prince in jail, jailed since last June. This is why we need an independent media in this country. We should be hearing this story daily. The name of the democratically elected Prime Minister, Ivan Neptune, why he is there, how the country suffered a coup last year in its bicentennial year when it should have been celebrating the oldest black republic in the world, born of a slave uprising in 1804. U.S. Congress didn't want to recognize it for decades because it didn't want to inspire slaves in this country to rise up. I wonder if Dred Scott had heard about what had happened in Haiti decades before. And yet 200 years later, yet another coup, February 29, 2004, when President Aristide was ousted in what he called a modern kidnapping in the service of a coup d'etat backed by the United States, sent off to the Central African Republic. And it was the role of independent media that brought this story out. But that is not enough. We have to break the sound barrier by joining together, and we are seeing it here. We are seeing it all over this country. Pacifica Radio, Low Power FM, public radio and television at times, public access TV, and we want to celebrate what we have here, right here in St. Louis, both KDHX and KDHX-TV, very powerful force, giving voice to the community right here, and just down the road in Champaign-Urbana, one of the most powerful indie media centers, they just bought the post office. That will be their new home. Talk about sending a message. But finally, Democracy Now! Had a chance to cover the return of President Aristide to this hemisphere. And I think this is very instructive about what we can accomplish. He's brought to the Central African Republic in a plane with U.S. military and security, doesn't know where he's going, together with his wife, the First Lady of Haiti, Mildred Aristide. And then the small delegation goes to retrieve them. corporate networks? Are they there to follow this historic mission? Absolutely remarkable. A mission that was put together by U.S. Congressmember Maxine Waters and the founder of TransAfrica, Randall Robinson, who got on a small plane, went to the Central African Republic to bring the Aristides back to this hemisphere. Democracy Now! Went on that trip to chronicle it. And when we got to the Central African Republic, reporting on this negotiation with the dictator, the U.S. certainly knows how to choose them, who is celebrating the first anniversary of his coup there. And then they got on the plane. They were able to get the Aristides out. As they negotiated in Bazize, the dictator would walk away. President Aristides said to me, he is going to get his marching orders from the U.S. and France. But the U.S. couldn't do anything at that point because they said that the Aristides had simply taken up residence in the Central African Republic, that they were free to leave. And now they had a means to go, and they couldn't be stopped. So they got on the plane, and we flew from Dakar, Senegal, to from Bangui, Central African Republic, to Dakar, Senegal, to the Cape Verde Islands across the Atlantic, to Barbados. And when we landed, Rumsfeld Rice and Powell were saying they were not to return to this hemisphere. Whose hemisphere? And this U.S. ambassador to Haiti said that they were not to return within 150 miles of Haiti. Whose country? And as we landed in Jamaica, well, all along the way, AP took our reports, CBS Radio was taking the reports as well as we were putting them on Democracy Now!, and then CNN called on the tarmac and said, tell us what happened. And as we talked, the lifestyle host who happened to be on at that moment, not realizing what was happening, thinking I was doing a vacation report from Jamaica, and someone is telling him in his ear, what about the violence? And he says, what about the violence? I said, knowing he's saying that Aristide would inspire violence, I said, it's very important you raise that issue because you have to look at the people involved in this coup that are in working with the United States. And talked about one man who'd been found guilty in absentia of the murder of the justice minister 10 years before and a Haitian businessman. This man's name, Jodel Chamblain, one of the key coup leaders. That you should raise this issue of violence because that's who's engaged in this coup. And the CNN host said, you're kidding. You put that together, CNN, CBS, AP, and indie media all over this country. I call that trickle-up journalism. That is just one example. But there is no question that what we can do in this country, working together, building up all these independent forum, working together, it is a force more powerful than anything the networks have presented at this point, if it also involves taking on the networks and challenging what has given them the right to take our property, this national treasure that are the public airwaves. I just want to let people know today at 4:30 that we'll be outside the lobby of the Millennium Hotel and we'll be leafleting commuters in St. Louis at, to let them know that KDHX is here, KDHX TV and radio. It's important we start locally and building from there. And I want to congratulate all of you for coming out. This is the beginning of a movement. It may not have hit the corporate media radar screen, but that may be a very good thing. It is up to you. We have a decision to make in this country. What we want the media to represent, I see it as a huge kitchen table that stretches across not only this country, but the globe, that we all sit around and debate and discuss the most important issues of the day. Life and death, war and peace. Anything less than that is a disservice to the servicemen and women of this country. Anything less than that is a disservice to a democratic society. Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy Goodman. Thank you, Malkia Cyril. Thank you, Mark Cooper. Thank you, Janine Jackson. Thank you all for coming. Go eat lunch, roll up your sleeves. We've got our marching orders.